Welcome to Food for Thought. My name is Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau from Compassionate Cooks. I founded Compassionate Cooks to empower people to make informed food choices, to debunk myths about veganism and animal rights, and to give people the tools and resources they need to live according to their own values of compassion and wellness. You can learn more about who we are and what we do by visiting our website, CompassionateCooks.com. Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for your patience. I can't believe it's been so long between episodes. I really apologize that it's taken so long. I've already started writing the next episode on restaurant outreach, encouraging restaurants to expand their vegan menus. So that one's not going to take as long to get to, I promise. But, you know, I'm not just sitting around eating bonbons. I hope you know that. That's not why it's taken so long. If there is such a thing as vegan bonbons and you'd like to send me some vegan bonbons, I would not protest. But that's not what I'm doing. As you know, Color Me Vegan, my third cookbook, came out in December of 2010. And my fourth book, my first non-cookbook, Vegan's Daily Companion, just came out on March 1st, 2011. And even though I delivered the manuscript for the 30-Day Vegan Challenge several months ago, there's still a lot of work to do where that's concerned. And of course, I'm traveling and speaking. I'm working on videos. We've got a video podcast now called The Compassionate Cook. So I encourage you to go to iTunes, and I almost said YouTunes, to iTunes and to subscribe to the video podcast. We're going to be putting videos up every couple weeks, probably. It's taken a while to get this going, but we're going to start doing that. You can also subscribe on YouTube or on Vimeo, and it's The Compassionate Cook is the name of the show. So that's keeping me busy, and I'm writing more than ever besides the books. And aside from my column in Veg News magazine, which I'm not sure I'm going to continue even for different reasons, but it looks like I'm going to be contributing to the Christian Science Monitor, thanks to podcast listener Susan Clay, and to a very meat-oriented magazine called Edible. So I'm really excited to be able to write for mainstream magazines. I'm going to see how that goes. I'm really proud of my new book, Vegan's Daily Companion. I'm thrilled by the responses to it so far. You can visit vegansdailycompanion.com to see what it's all about and to read sample content. Basically, it's broken up by themes based on the day of the week. So Monday is food, Tuesdays are effective communication, Wednesdays are optimal health, body, mind, and spirit, Thursdays is animals and the arts. So if you've liked any of the short stories I've read on the podcast here, you can see them, summaries of them, and more, and poetry and references to art, just a lot more in Vegan's Daily Companion. Fridays is stories of hope and rescue, and that includes people's stories of transformation and also animals who have been rescued and find sanctuary. And then Saturdays and Sundays is recipes. And half of the recipes are my favorites from my existing cookbooks, and half are new recipes, brand new recipes. There was a very good reason I had to do half existing recipes. My publisher would have expected another cookbook from me if I were to do all new recipes, so I had to compromise. And that's how I chose to do half from the existing cookbooks, the first three cookbooks, and half that are new. So if you're wondering why there are repeats, that is why. But they really are my favorites. So you can find those on Saturdays and Sundays. And so you can go to vegansdailycompanion.com to see more. And I want to thank Juliet Lynn, who generously designed and built that website completely pro bono. Juliet has also done the same thing for vegantable.com and colormevegan.com. So thank you so much, Juliet. Regarding my books, reviews on your blogs, on your Facebook pages, on websites, and yes, on the behemoth Amazon.com, where everyone looks at book reviews, whether you like them or not, would be so wonderful. I appreciate it so much. And keep this in mind, when I was writing my proposal for the 30-Day Vegan Challenge, which was purchased by Random House, one of the things, you know, you have to show them is what kind of response my previous work received. They need to know that, not only in terms of book sales, but in terms of customer reviews. So they go look at Amazon. It was one of the things that I had to put in the proposal, was, you know, really quantifying how many reviews I had on Amazon for my other books. And I know it seems silly, but those are the kinds of things that people look at. So for anyone who's ever said, I wish you could get out there more, I wish you could have your own TV show, you know, I wish you could, I just wish more people knew about you, and I'm really working to manifest a television show. I mean, that's really where we want to go next, I think. If you want to make the smallest contribution toward making that happen, please post reviews on Amazon, because producers and publishers will look there. Those are the kinds of things they look at. So that's a really easy way you can help. You can help out. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. And as always, I'm incredibly grateful to all of our amazing members who support the many projects that I am working on. Your support means more than you'll ever know. The long-term plan is really to bump up the membership even more, especially in terms of benefits. And we've got some really exciting projects in the works. Right now, my pro bono angel, Amanda Mitchell, who some of you have had contact with, she manages the membership program for me while also handling my emails. And she creates the monthly newsletters now. And she lives across the country. She does it for free. She has a full-time job, a full-time husband, and full-time doggies. And so my hope is to be able to manifest enough abundance to be able to bring her on for real. But it's just not possible right now. But with your help, we can make it possible. And so some of the members helping make this possible are Pamela Rossio, Kathy Patikin, Jennifer Kearns, who's a renewing member, Valerie McGowan, who's a renewing member, Sarah Harding of Sarah Daniel Design. And that's Sarah of Sarah Danielle Designs. And you can see her beautiful jewelry at sarahdanielledesigns.com. Here's an excerpt from an email from Jennifer Kearns. You've inspired me over the past 2 years and helped lead me into the journey to become vegan. Your podcast caught my eye on iTunes while I was searching out vegetarian shows to listen to while I ran. There are two very special animals who I encounter while running each day, a lovely horse named Shadow, who shares the name of our beloved adopted kitty, and also a great dog named Cole, who joins me at the top of the hill I run and follows me home. So I dedicate my decision to change my lifestyle to them and all the other animals out there. My husband has expanded his palate as well, so I keep spreading those seeds. On that note, I found that when I became vegetarian, the comments I received were for the most part very positive. However, when I decided to become vegan and live that lifestyle, doing what I could to help alleviate the suffering of all animals, the responses were very negative. What are you, crazy? You can't do that. You'll get sick, etc. At first, it was very disheartening, but I re-listened with gusto to many of your podcasts. Then a funny thing began to happen. My workplace hosted an employee dinner, and I requested a vegan meal. They were very open to that. And over time, more and more people are very interested in my diet and the reasons behind it. I wish I could tell others who are thinking of becoming vegan to just hang in there and be patient, because I believe in time the world will become more aware of what the meat, dairy, and egg industries are doing. There will be a change. I've never felt more sure of the good I can do by spreading those seeds. I agree, Jennifer. That's fantastic. And an email excerpt from Kathy Patikin. I recently, in the spirit of joyfulness, in my newfound veganism for the last year, gladly became a member of Compassionate Cooks. This last year has changed my family and myself forever. In a long process over many years, I was vegetarian off and on. I would do it for my health, my weight, my mood, etc. Stress would overtake me and I would revert back to easy. But this way of life kept knocking on my door. Then I found your podcast and listened and realized my commitment is to a gentle life for all. I've now been fully vegan without even a glimmer of hesitation for 1 year. I've never felt better. I've lost 30 pounds without even trying, just a great side effect. And the best part is the overwhelming spiritual connection I feel and live every day. The fact is, veganism has penetrated my life on every level. I have found peace despite the negative attitudes of others in the workplace and have given up oppression of any species to the very best of my ability to live a full, rich, joyful life without perpetuating violence. Many thank yous in loving gratitude and peace for you to continue your very important work towards the ideal we strive for in our hearts. Thank you so much for giving so much, as my pocket change every month is nothing compared to the lives you save. Well, we're all saving. We're all saving, Kathy. I mean, every one of us is making contribution when we make the decision to stop contributing to this incredibly violent industry. So it is my pleasure and my honor, and I'm very grateful for your support. So thank you all. If you'd like to become a member of the Compassionate Cooks Club, please visit CompassionateCooks.com and click on Join the Club. Various thank you gifts come with your support. And for a long time, people would write and ask how they could financially support our work without becoming a member, aside from people who contribute their skills. We certainly have those people as well, which is amazing. But we finally added a way to do this, and I know I probably should have done this a long time ago. So if you click on the Join the Club button, you'll land on the membership page, and the first button you'll see, it features a beautiful steer from Farm Sanctuary, says Support Us, and it's just a way of making a contribution of any amount that you like without becoming a member. So there aren't frills and benefits other than our extreme gratitude and knowing that you're really truly helping us. But you can just do that if you like and not become a member. But all of those options are there if you click on join the club. So thank you for requesting that. Thank you for your support. And thank you, of course, to all the listeners and all the podcast subscribers. So let's move on to the topic here. Some of you may remember my podcast episode called The Fall of the Excusitarians, which was a follow-up to an earlier episode called The Rise of the Excusitarians. In that early episode, I talked about how outrageous it was that nobody was calling out Michael Pollan and other excusitarians for the ridiculous, romanticized justifications for eating animals. And I closed with a reading of Hans Christian Andersen's story, The Emperor's New Clothes, in order to emphasize my distress over the fact that nobody was piercing through their illusion that they're doing something right by animals by killing them and eating them, but of course labeling their actions as traditional or humane or sustainable. And this is a topic that, you know, is really something that I'm going to continue focusing on. Not long after that, not long after that first episode, The Rise of the Excusitarians, with great joy, I discovered the writings of Brian Myers. His byline is often B.R. Myers, particularly his piece called Hard to Swallow. And it was the first time I had seen anyone take Michael Pollan to task in a prominent publication. So Myers is a contributing editor to The Atlantic, and he's a brilliant thinker and a brilliant writer at that. So in the Fall of the Excusitarians episode, I read Myers' Atlantic piece called Hard to Swallow. Well, today I'm back to share with you Myers' newest piece, The Moral Crusade Against Foodies, which appeared in the March 2011 issue of The Atlantic. I first heard about this latest article from Myers himself, but it took me a few weeks to finally read it. I wanted to take in every word. I didn't want to read it on my computer. I try to get off my computer as much as possible. So I printed it out, and I finally found some time to sit down and read it. And I read it on a Friday evening at a local cafe, after which time my husband was picking me up to go grab some dinner. And I got in the car and I said I needed to tell him something. I said he might not be happy about it, but he had a right to know. I said, I love Brian Myers. And I proceeded to enthusiastically share with him my thoughts about the article. And I don't think David's read it yet. I'm just anxious for him to read it because it's just amazing. But David understood. He understood, and he allows me my affection for Brian. And as a bonus, when I wrote to Brian to say, I love you, warning David that I was doing so, Brian returned the affection and said he loves me too, which is really lovely. So I adore Brian. And I'm so thrilled he's out there piercing through the illusion. He is, however, getting pummeled because of it, pummeled by prominent and not so prominent excusitarians all over the internet. Writers and bloggers on various websites for various publications are smearing his work. A writer for Salon says, B.R. Myers' excoriation of food lovers in The Atlantic is furious and vicious. It's also dumb and sad. Another in The Village Voice says, yes, foodies are ridiculous, but so is B.R. Myers. And of course, many, often passive-aggressively or just aggressively, point out that Myers is vegan and thus biased and full of disdain for meat eaters. Typically, one animal-eating critic usurps the moral high ground by claiming animal ethics is indeed the realm of the meat eater, this critic writes. As his, Myers, real target, the non-vegan, heaves into view, we breathe a collective sigh of relief since foodies are now apparently in a more defensible position. Don't we celebrate the humane treatment of animals on small local farms? Aren't we concerned about the cruelty and health hazards represented by feedlots? Isn't sustainability of the food supply one of our primary goals? He and others who dismiss Myers' argument because he's vegan is the most ironic to me, because the criticism of Myers is coming from those who revel in eating animals and just cannot or will not see that their embrace of quote-unquote humane and quote-unquote sustainable labels are just cloaks to mask what is essentially desire and not necessity. And by virtue of that, it's selfish. And I realize using the word selfish or talking about the selfish gluttony of animal eaters sounds like a judgment, which automatically puts people on the defensive, especially those people I want to hear what I'm saying. But I'm not saying selfish as a judgment. It's really what it comes down to, because we have no need for animal flesh and no need to consume animal fluids. We are quite literally eating them out of our desire for pleasure. I realize culture and habit play a huge role, but really the people who most strongly defend eating animals do so on the basis of their personal right to do so. And of course, they have a bias. Of course, they have a bias. They're looking through the lens of a meat eater, which is their bias. And this goes back to an early episode of mine where I talk about the fact that the dominant animal eating group always talk about how vegans are biased, as if to be vegan is to take a position, but to eat or promote or condone eating animals and their products is neutral. Of course, it's not neutral. It is taking a position, period. So for instance, one critic of Myers writes, quote, his take on foodies' concern for the lives of the animals they've eaten, for instance, is narrow-minded to the extreme. Instead of seeing the good that comes from promoting small farming operations that treat their animals well, he sees doublespeak. He's talking about Myers, this critic. Myers sees doublespeak, affectations of piety and feigned concern all on the part of foodies. Yes, of course it's doublespeak. Of course they're affectations of piety, all in the name of eating animals. Many of Meyer's critics blast him for lumping all of the foodies together, defending Michael Pollan and conceding that Michael Pollan should not be judged the way Anthony Bourdain is, for instance. One such critic writes, unfortunately, though, Meyer's groups all foodies under the banner of gluttony. Surely this isn't correct. After all, the mantra of Michael Pollan, whose book The Omnivore's Dilemma, Meyer explains, now informs all food writing, is eat food, not too much, mostly plants. Gorging is conspicuously absent. So he's defending Michael Pollan there, saying that Michael Pollan isn't like all of these other people, like the Anthony Bourdains and other people you'll hear me described in Meyer's article. But, you know, two things here. One is that this critic and many others miss Meyer's point that gluttony, as it's now defined and understood, no longer just means gorging. It refers to a self-entitlement to consume whoever we want, whenever we want, and as much as we want. And of course, they'll assert that it's ungracious and it's rude to not eat something offered to you in someone else's home or someone else's country. But that's another story. But that's along the same lines. Like, you know, we can do whatever we want, and to not do so is rude. So by that definition, self-entitled consumption, Pollan most certainly belongs in the same camp. He's all about self-entitlement. This is a man who may have written Eat Food, Not Too Much, Mostly Plants, but who at every opportunity talks about eating animals. And as I've been saying for years, he doesn't just praise the consumption of animal flesh. He belittles vegans for not eating animals. If you watched the Oprah show that had on Michael Pollan and Cargill and Kathy Freston, you'll remember that when Oprah asked Pollan what his thoughts were about veganism, he basically said it's an affront to tradition, and I've heard him say this before, because we've always eaten meat. And he said, and I quote, frankly, I think it's an insult to your mother. This is the same guy who said that by not eating animals, we're denying our evolutionary heritage and we're sacrificing our human identity. Now, as much as his condescension really just gets under my skin, the good news about his defense of eating animals is that that's the best he's got. Those are his best arguments, that we're denying our evolutionary heritage, as if that's what people are thinking when they sit down to eat, that they're actually, you know, adhering to their evolutionary heritage. I just don't think people who are sitting down to enjoy steak are saying, I feel so good about adhering to my evolutionary heritage, and I feel so good that I'm not sacrificing my human identity. They're doing it because they want to eat meat. So it's just ridiculous. These are the best arguments they've got. And the problem is that either nobody calls them out on how absurd this reasoning is, or those that do don't have a large enough platform to be heard. And so one of my next books, possibly the one that follows the 30-Day Vegan Challenge, will be one that will respond to all of the typical excuses and justifications that the excusitarians are making. And for all intents and purposes, I'm calling it the Omnivore's Delusion. I will most likely not call it that officially because it's a little too provocative and I really want people to read it. I don't want to seem like I'm creating a dichotomy. But really, for all intents and purposes, that's what we're talking about here, the Omnivore's Delusion. So, and I know it's a tough subject to tackle because it's so emotional on all sides and everyone gets their hackles raised when they talk about this subject, including me. But that's why I admire Brian so much. It takes a lot of courage, not only to have written the article that he wrote, but to have read all the books that he had to read in order to write it. When he'll talk about some of these books, I see these books all around stores, all around Berkeley, all around Oakland, all of these books that are just celebrating the consumption of animals in this very sexualized, sensualized, romanticized way. It's just so, it's so macabre. But what disheartens me a bit is that you see very little cheering for Myers in the vegan community, if they've heard of him at all. Now, this isn't the case with everyone, but I do think that the vegan community is a little too silent when it comes to criticizing the excusitarian, foodie, humane farmer, Michael Pollan type, whatever you want to call it, excusitarians. And I think it's because they wrongly perceive them, people in the Michael Pollan camp, as more aligned with vegans than your average animal eater. But I vehemently disagree. I think they have usurped the ethics around food and they dominate the discourse. I would rather deal with an average Joe meat eater consuming factory farmed meat in terms of a dialogue, in terms of a conversation, than the I'm going to hurt myself patting myself on the back consumer of what is labeled humane meat any day. Though the perception is that the latter is more aware of and more concerned about where their, you know, meat is coming from than the average meat eater. The trouble is they think they have found the solution and they don't think they have anything else to do. They don't think they have anywhere else to go. Veganism to them is not the solution. Not eating animals to them is not even on the table. That's not even in their purview. That's not part of the solution. Their desire to eat meat with a clear conscience is what it comes down to. So any label slapped on an animal product that meets this end affords them this. Now, I'm saying all of this because I think it's important to be aware of what's happening out there so that we can respond to it articulately and compassionately. And yes, I have to make a conscious effort to find compassion in my heart for Michael Pollan and others like him, but I really do try. I can still have compassion and be critical. They're not mutually exclusive. I can do both. So to that end, I do suggest that we make sure that we let The Atlantic know that Myers' piece is very much appreciated. I'm sure they've heard some positive responses, but they've heard a lot of negative ones too. Now, the bottom line is negative responses sell magazines. So it's not like Brian won't be writing for them just because they get negative emails, but they need to know that there are people who support his perspective. It's annoying. I couldn't find a specific email address for The Atlantic, but if you go to theatlantic.com, click on Contact Us, there's a form you can use to send a letter, and I please encourage you to do this. I also encourage you to pass the article around to other vegans and like-minded people so they can read, what's going on. I mean, Brian really, he goes through all of the literature. He goes through all of the language and the excuses and justifications they're using. And I think it's important to be able to know what, you know, what it is they're saying and the excuses that they're using. You can send it to non-vegans. I think it's a tough piece to read if you're in the mindset of justifying eating animals. His logic and outrage are clear to me and I get it, but that's because I woke up from my justifying ways. I used to justify too, and I'm trying to imagine what it would be like for me to be reading this piece back when I was eating animals. Now, when I was eating animals, I wasn't a foodie. I wasn't in the foodie mindset. And of course it's huge right now, but I did justify my consumption of them. So my point is that I think that more vegans need to be aware of how much the foodie, humane meat, Michael Pollan mindset is dominating the conversation and how we need to articulately respond to their romanticizing of animal consumption. And perhaps Brian's article will help you do that. So I'm going to read it to you now. You can find it online if you don't want to listen to my voice for the next, I don't know how long it's going to take to read it. You can find it at theatlantic.com, or you can just type in the title, which is Moral Crusade Against Foodies. You can type it into Google and find it. So I'll probably have one thing to say at the end, but I'm going to read the article right now. So B.R. Myers, Moral Crusade Against Foodies. We have all dined with him in restaurants, the host who insists on calling his special friend out of the kitchen for some awkward small talk. The publishing industry also wants us to meet a few chefs, only these are in no hurry to get back to work. Anthony Bourdain's new book, his 10th, is Medium Raw, A Bloody Valentine to the World of Food and the People Who Cook. In it, he announces in his trademark thuggish style that it is now time to make the idea of not cooking uncool and in the harshest way possible, short of physical brutality, drive that message home. Having finished the book, I think I'd rather have absorbed a few punches and had the rest of the evening to myself. No more readable for being an artsier affair is Chef Gabrielle Hamilton's memoir, Blood, Bones, and Butter. Then there's Kim Severinsen's Spoon-Fed, How Eight Cooks Saved My Life, which is the kind of thing that passes for spiritual uplift in this set. Quote, what blessed entity invented sugar and cacao pods and vanilla beans or figured out that salt can preserve and brighten anything? Unquote. And I thought I knew where that sentence was going. The flyleaf calls Spoon-Fed, quote, a testament to the wisdom that can be found in the kitchen, unquote, agreed. To put aside these books after a few chapters is to feel a sense of liberation. It's like stepping from a crowded, fetid restaurant into silence and fresh air. But only when writing such things for their own kind do so-called foodies truly let down their guard, which makes for some engrossing passages here and there. For insight, too. The deeper an outsider ventures into this stuff, the clearer a unique community comes into view. In values, sense of humor, even childhood experiences, its members are as similar to each other as they are different from everyone else. For one thing, these people really do live to eat. Vogue's restaurant critic, Jeffrey Steingarten, says he spends the afternoon, or a week of afternoons, planning the perfect dinner of barbecued ribs or braised foie gras. Michael Pollan boasts in the New York Times of his latest 36-hour dinner party. Similar schedules and priorities can be inferred from the work of other writers. These include a sort of milquetoast priest, anthologized in Best Food Writing 2010, who expounds unironically on the ritual of making the perfect slice. And when foodies talk of flying to Paris to buy cheese, to Vietnam to sample pho, that's the beef noodle soup, they're not joking about that either. Needless to say, no one shows much interest in literature or the arts, the real arts. When Marcel Proust's name pops up, you know you're just going to hear about that damned Madeleine again. It has always been crucial to the gourmet's pleasure that he eat in ways the mainstream cannot afford. For hundreds of years, this meant consuming enormous quantities of meat. That of animals that had been whipped to death was more highly valued for centuries, in the belief that pain and trauma enhanced taste. Quote, a true gastronome, unquote, according to a British dining manual of the time, quote, is as insensible to suffering as is a conqueror, end quote. But for the past several decades, factory farms have made meat ever cheaper, and as the excellent book The CAFO, Concentrated Animal Feeding Operations Reader, makes clear, the pain and trauma are thrown in for free. The contemporary gourmet reacts by voicing an ever stronger preference for free-range meats from small local farms. He even claims to believe that well-treated animals taste better, though his heart isn't really in it. Steingarten tells of watching four people hold down a struggling, groaning pig for a full 20 minutes as it bled to death for his dinner. He calls the animal, quote, a filthy beast deserving its fate, unquote. Even if gourmet's rejection of factory farms and fast food is largely motivated by their traditional elitism, it has left them, for the first time in the history of their community, feeling more moral, spiritual even, than the man on the street. Food writing reflects this change. Since the late 1990s, the guilty smirkiness that once marked its default style has been losing ever more ground to pomposity and sermonizing. References to cooks as gods, to restaurants as temples, to biting into heaven, etc., used to be meant as jokes, even if the compulsive recourse to religious language always betrayed a certain guilt about the stomach-driven life. Now the equation of eating with worship is often made with a straight face. The mood at a dinner table depends on the quality of food served. If culinary perfection is achieved, the meal becomes downright holy, as we learned from Pollan's The Omnivore's Dilemma, in which a pork dinner is described as, quote, feeling like a ceremony, a secular seder. The moral logic in Pollan's hugely successful book now informs all food writing. The refined palate rejects the taste of factory farmed meat, of the corn syrupy junk food that sickens the poor, of frozen fruits and vegetables transported wastefully across oceans, from which it follows that to serve one's palate is to do right by small farmers, factory-abused cows, the earth itself. This affectation of piety does not keep foodies from vaunting their penchant for obscenely priced meals, for gorging themselves, even for dining on endangered animals, but only rarely is public attention drawn to the contradiction. This has much to do with the fact that the nation's media tend to leave the national food discourse to the foodies in their ranks, to people like Pollan himself and Severinsen, his very like-minded colleague at the New York Times. Is any other subculture reported on so exclusively by its own members, or with a frequency and an extensiveness that bear so little relation to its size? The slow food movement that we keep hearing about has fewer than 20,000 members nationwide. The same bias is apparent in writing that purports to be academic or at least serious. The book Gluttony, 2003, one of a series of the Seven Deadly Sins, was naturally assigned to a foodie writer, namely Francine Prose, who writes for the gourmet magazine Savour. Not surprisingly, she regards gluttony primarily as a problem of overeating to the point of obesity. It is, quote, the only sin whose effects are visible, written on the body. In fact, the Catholic Church's criticism of gluttony, against gluttony, has always been directed against an inordinate preoccupation with food, against foodieism, in other words, which we encounter as often among thin people as among fat ones. A disinterested writer would likely have done the subject more justice. Unfortunately, even the new sociological study, Foodies, Democracy and Distinction in the Gourmet Foodscape, is the product of two self-proclaimed members of the tribe, Jose Johnston and Cheyenne Bauman, who pull their punches accordingly. The introduction is titled Entering the Delicious World of Foodies. In short, the 21st century gourmet need fear little public contradiction when striking sanctimonious poses. The same goes for restaurant owners like Alice Waters, a celebrated slow food advocate and the founder of an exclusive eatery in Berkeley. She is one of the chefs profiled in Spoonfed. Her streamlined philosophy, Severinsen tells us, is that the most political act we can commit is to eat delicious food that is produced in a way that is sustainable, that doesn't exploit workers, and is eaten slowly and with reverence. Unquote. A vegetarian diet, in other words, please. The reference is to Chez Panisse's standard fare. Severinsen cites, quote, grilled rack of loin of Magruder Ranch veal as a typical offering, which is environmentally sustainable only because so few people can afford it. Whatever one may think of Anthony Bourdain's moral sense, his BS detector seems to be working fine. In Medium Raw, he congratulates Waters on having, quote, made lust, greed, hunger, self-gratification, and fetishism look good, unquote. Not to everyone, perhaps, but okay. The Roman historian Livy, L-I-V-Y, famously regarded the glorification of chefs as the sign of a culture in decline. I wonder what he would have thought of the New York Times' effort to admit, quote, young idols with cleavers into America's pantheon of food service heroes. Here's a little quote. With their swinging scabbards, muscled forearms, and constant proximity to flesh, butchers have the raw emotional appeal of an indie band. Think about it. What's sexy? Said Tia Keenan, the fromager, I guess it's the cheese person, at Quisuela Cheese and Wine Cafe, and an unabashed butcher fan. Quote, dangerous is sometimes sexy, and they are generally big guys with knives who are covered in blood. I can't help but think of our Isaac Bashevis Singer short story we read called Blood. Remember that? Go back and listen to that or read that story if you want to know why I'm thinking of that at this time. That's Severinsen again, by the way, and she records no word of dissent in regard to the cheese vendor's ravings. We are to believe this is a national trend here. In fact, the public perception of butchers has not changed in the slightest, as can easily be confirmed by telling someone that he or she looks like one. Blankly as a butcher stares, Auden's famous line about the moon. We'll need no explanatory footnote even a century from now. But food writing has long specialized in the barefaced inversion of common sense, common language. Restaurant reviews are notorious for touting $100 lunches as great value for money. The doublespeak now comes in more pious tones, especially when foodies feign concern for animals. Crowding around to watch the slaughter of a pig, even getting it in its face just before the shot, is described by Bethany Jean Clement in an article in Best Food Writing 2009 as quote-unquote solemn and quote-unquote respectful behavior. Pollan writes about going with a friend to watch a goat get killed. Quote, Mike says the experience made him want to honor our goat by wasting as little of it as possible, unquote. It's teachable fun for the whole foodie family. The full strangeness of this culture sinks in when one reads affectionate accounts, again in Best Food Writing 2009, of children clamoring to kill their own cow or wanting to see a pig shot, then ripped open with a chainsaw. Here, too, though, an at least half-serious moral logic is at work, backed up by the subculture's distinct body of myth, which combines half-understood evolutionary theory with the biblical idea of man as born lord of the world. Anthropological research, I should perhaps point out, now indicates that Homo sapiens started out as a paltry prey animal. Clawless, fangless, and slight of build, he could at best look forward to furtive boltings of carrion until the day he became meat himself. It took humans quite a while to learn how to gang up for self-protection and food acquisition, the latter usually a hyena-style affair of separating infant or sick animals from the herds. The domestication of pigs, cows, chickens, etc. has been going on for only about 10,000 years, not nearly long enough to breed the instincts out of them. The hideous paraphernalia of subjugation pictured in the CAFO reader, it's not there for nothing. Now for the foodie version. The human animal evolved with eyes in the front of its head, long legs, fingernails, eye teeth, so that it could better chase down the slower, stupider creatures, kill them, and eat them. This is Bourdain from Medium Raw. We have eaten them for so long that meat-eating has shaped our souls, says Pollen in The Omnivore's Dilemma. Oh my lord. And after so many millennia of domestication, food animals have become evolutionarily hardwired to depend on us, says chef-writer Hugh Fernley Wittenstall in the River Cottage Meat book. Every exercise of our hungry power is thus part of the great food chain of being with which we must align our morals. Deep down, instinctively, if not consciously, the hardwired pig understands all this, understands why he has suddenly been dragged before a leering crowd. Just don't waste any of him afterward, that's all he asks. Note that the foodie's pride in eating nose to tail is no different from factory farm boasts of using everything but the oink. As if such token frugality could make up for the caloric wastefulness and environmental damage that result from meat farming. Naturally, the food-obsessed profess as much respect for tradition as for evolution. Hamilton, in Blood, Bones, and Butter, writes of her childhood dinners. The meal was always organized correctly, traditionally, which I now appreciate. Even relatively young traditions, like the Thanksgiving turkey, must be guarded zealously against efforts to change or opt out of them. I talked about this in a Thanksgiving episode I did. Foreign traditions destigmatize every dish, even for the American. In Best Food Writing 2010, one foie gras lover asks another whether he would eat tortured cat if there were sufficient Mongolian history behind the dish. The answer is yes. So tradition is an absolute good? No. When it dictates abstention from a certain food, it is to be rejected. Francine Prose shows how it's done in her prize-winning Savour article, Faith and Bacon. I need hardly explain which of those two she cannot live without. Prose concedes that since pigs compete ravenously with humans for grain, her Jewish forefathers' taboo against pork may well have derived from ecological reasons that are even more valid today. Yet she finds it unrealistic to hope that humans could ever suppress their baser appetites for the benefit of other humans' flora or fauna. She then drops the point entirely. Foodies quickly lose interest in any kind of abstract discussion. The reader is left to infer that since baser appetites are going to rule anyway, we might as well give in to them. But if, however unlikely it seems, this is a quote from Prose's article. But if, however unlikely it seems, I ever find myself making one of those late life turns toward God, one thing I promise you is that this God will be a deity who wants me to feel exactly the way I feel when the marbled slice of pork floats up to the top of the bowl of ramen. This is back to Myers. Yes, I feel equally sure that Prose's God will be that kind of God. At least she maintains a civil tone when talking of kashrut. In Killer Food, another article in Best Food Writing 2010, Dana Goodyear tells how a restaurant served head cheese, meat jelly made from an animal's head, to an unwitting Jew. This is a quote. Forgive the profanity. This is in the quote. One woman, when Chef John Shook finally had a chance to explain, spat it out on the table and said, "Oh my fucking God, I've been kosher for 32 years. Shook giggled, recollecting, "Not anymore, you ain't." We are meant to chuckle too. The woman, who I am sure expressed herself in less profane terms, got what she deserved. Most of us consider it a virtue to maintain our principles in the face of social pressure. But in the involuted world of gourmet morals, constancy is rudeness. One must never spoil a dinner party for mere religious or ethical reasons. Pollan says he sides with the French in regarding, quote, any personal dietary prohibition as bad manners. The American foodie is forever projecting his own barbarism onto France. Bourdain writes, taking your belief system on the road or to other people's houses makes me angry. The sight of vegetarian tourists waving away a Vietnamese pho vendor fills him with spluttering indignation. That's right. Guests have a greater obligation to please their host and passersby to please a vendor than vice versa. Is there any civilized value that foodies cannot turn on its head? But I assume Bourdain has no qualms about waving away a flower seller, just as Pollan probably sees nothing wrong with a Mormon's refusal a cup of coffee. Enjoinders to put the food provider's feelings above all else are just part of the greater effort to sanctify food itself. So secure is the gourmet community. And of course, I talk about this in Speaking Your Truth. So I do talk about this idea of speaking up for what you believe in and not being ashamed or apologetic about it. But back to the article. So secure is the gourmet community in its newfound reputation, so sure of its rightness, that it now proclaims the very qualities, greed, indifference to suffering, the prioritization of food above all, that earned it so much obloquy in the first place. Bourdain starts off his book by reveling in the illegality of a banquet at which he and some famous unnamed chefs dined on ortolan, which is endangered songbirds fattened up, as he unselfconsciously tells us, in pitch dark cages. And again, there's a little swear here. This is not mine. Close your ears if you don't want to hear it. After the meal, an identical just fucked look graced each diner's face. Eating equal sex, and in accordance with this self-flattery, gorging is presented in terms of athleticism and endurance. Quote again, you eat way past the point of hitting the wall, or I do anyway. If nothing else, Bourdain at least gives the lie to the Pollan-Severson cant about foodieism being an integral part of the whole, truly sociable human being. In Bourdain's world, diners are as likely to sit solo or at a countertop while chewing their way through a fucking Everest of shellfish. My God, Bourdain swears a lot in his book. Contributors to the best food writing anthology celebrate the same mindless, sweating gluttony. You eat and eat and eat, Todd Kilman writes, long after you're full. Being overstuffed for the food lover is not a moral problem. This is all a quote from Todd Kilman. But then what is? In the same analogy, Michael Steinberger extols the pleasure of, quote, joyfully gorging yourself on a bird bearing the liver of another bird, unquote. He also talks of, quote, whimpering with ecstasy in a French restaurant, then allowing the chef to hit on his wife because, quote, I was in too much of a stupor. He had just served me one of the finest dishes I'd ever eaten, unquote. Hyperbole, the reader will have noticed, remains the central comic weapon in the food writer's arsenal. It gets old fast, nor is there much sign of wit in the table talk recorded. Aquinas said gluttony leads to, quote, loudishness, uncleanliness, talkativeness, and an uncomprehending dullness of mind, unquote. And if you don't believe him, here's Kilman again. Oh, I guess it's Kleiman. Here's Kleiman again. I watched tears streak down a friend's face as he popped expertly cleavered bites of chicken into his mouth. He was red-eyed and breathing fast. It hurts, but it's so good, but it hurts, and I can't stop eating. He slammed a fist down on the table, the beer in his glass schlossed over the sides. Jesus Christ, I've got to stop. We've already seen that the foodie respects only those customs, traditions, beliefs, cultures, old and new, domestic and foreign, that call on him to eat more, not less. But the foodie is even more insatiable in regard to variety than quantity. Johnston and Bauman note that, quote, eating unusual foods is part of what generates foodie status, unquote. And indeed, there appears to be no greater point of pride in this set than to eat with the indiscriminate omnivorousness of a rat in a zoo dumpster. Jeffrey Steingarten called his first book The Man Who Ate Everything. Bourdain writes with equal swagger, I've eaten raw seal, guinea pig, I've eaten bat. The book Foodies quotes a middle-aged software engineer who says, it's not something I would be anxious to repeat, but it's kind of weird and cool to say I've had goat testicles in rice wine. The taste of these bizarre meals, as researchers of oral fixation will not be surprised to learn, is neither here nor there. Members of the Gastronauts, a foodie group in New York, stuff live squirming octopuses and eels down their throats before posting the carny-esque footage online. Such antics are encouraged in the media with reports of the exotic foods that can only be had overseas, beyond the reach of FDA inspectors, conservationists, and animal rights activists. Not too long ago, MSNBC put out an article titled Some Bravery as a Side Dish. It listed seven foods for the fearless stomach, one of which was ortolan, the endangered songbirds fattened in dark boxes. The more lives sacrificed for a dinner, the more impressive the eater. Dana Goodyear, quote, 30 duck hearts in curry. The ethos of this kind of cooking is undeniably macho, unquote. Amorality as ethos, callousness as bravery, queenly self-absorption as machismo. No small perversion of language is needed to spin heroism out of an evening spent in a chair. Of course, the bulk of foodie writing falls between the extremes of Pollan-esque sanctimony and Bourdainian oafishness. The average article in a best food writing anthology is a straightforward, if very detailed, discussion of some treat or another, usually interwoven with a chronicle of the writer's quest to find or make it in a perfect form. 7 pages on sardines, 8 pages on marshmallow fluff. The lack of drama and effect only makes the gloating obsessiveness even more striking. The following, from a man who travels the world sampling oysters, is typical. Sitting at Bentley's lustrous marble bar, I ordered 3 number 1 and 3 number 2 Strangford lofts and a martini. I was promptly set up with a dark green and gold placemat, a napkin, silverware, a bread plate, an oyster plate, some fresh bread, a plate of deep yellow butter rounds, vinegar, red pepper, Tabasco sauce, and a saucer full of lemons wrapped in cheesecloth. Bentley's is a very serious oyster bar. When the bartender asked me if I wanted olives or a twist, I asked him which garnish he liked better with oysters. He recommended both. I had never seen both garnishes served together, but I used to reject that old countercultural argument, the one about the difference between a legitimate pursuit of pleasure and an addiction or pathology being primarily a question of social license. I don't anymore. After a month among the bat eaters and milquetoast priests, I opened Nikki Sixx's Heroin Diaries and encountered a refreshingly sane-seeming young man, self-critical and with a dazzlingly wide range of interests. Unfortunately, the foodie fringe enjoys enough media access to make daily claims for its sophistication and virtue, for the sustainability of its lifestyle as a model for the world. We should not let it get away with those claims. Whether gluttony is a deadly sin is, of course, for the religious to decide, and I hope they go easy on the foodies. They're not all bad. They are certainly single-minded, however, and single-mindedness, even in less obviously selfish forms, is always a littleness of soul. So there you have it. There's Meyer's moral crusade against foodies. It's, you know, he really takes them to task. Obviously, he's not mild in his criticism of them. And I'm just so glad, because we have really given over ethics and like he's saying, tradition and culture, all of it over to even good manners over to the foodies. We have let them dominate that discourse. And for anyone who's ever agreed or anyone who's ever nodded in shame that we're doing something wrong by not accepting something offered to us in someone else's home, etc. I mean, we've really just let them usurp the moral high ground. And so those are the kinds of things I wanted to make sure were pointed out from Meyer's article, the justifications that are used to defend this the self-entitlement, this gluttony in terms of eating anybody we want, but feeling really good about it and actually doing so on the basis of tradition and culture and good manners and sustainability and, you know, all of these things. You know, I love when he talks about domestication. That's one of my favorite parts because I'm really interested in that. And the idea that the animals are in cahoots with us, and, you know, you'd think the animals, you know, signed a waiver because they wanted to sacrifice themselves for us, is one of the things that we also have given over to the foodie excusitarian camp. And by the way, if you're interested in more of that, there's an episode I have called The Favors We Do Animals, which talks about how this idea of domestication and breeding and killing them, all of these different things that we do in this artificial process of breeding and killing animals, we're actually doing them a favor and we're actually doing good by them by domesticating them and breeding them and killing them. I talk about that in that episode called The Favors We Do Animals. Now, I realize that there are people, vegans, who consider themselves foodies. And if you want to consider yourself a foodie because you enjoy food and because you love the sensuality of it, I don't think that's what we're talking about here. You know, I think there's a fine line, because I think on one hand, you know, it's okay to want really good food. It's okay to want food that is truly sustainable. But it's really a difference between, I think, the effect and the cause. I mean, I want to make sure that the food I'm eating doesn't cause anybody any harm, to people, to animals. And I make decisions based on that as much as I can. And I want good food. I want food that has a sensuality to it. That's why I teach cooking. That's why I have food recipes, because I want people to really enjoy what they're doing. But to the degree that it actually becomes sexualized and sensualized and romanticized to defend the people you are hurting and the animals you are hurting, that's when I think it crosses the line. So please don't take this as an excoriation of all foodieism, including just appreciating food if you're vegan. It's more along the lines of the absurdity and the extremeness of this way of living and eating, to the detriment and to the exclusion of anything else, of any other morals or ethics. That's what we're talking about here. So there you go. There is Meyer's piece, The Moral Crusade Against Foodies. Please, you know, certainly discuss among yourselves, maybe take it in, maybe print it out and kind of look at some of your favorite moments. Thank Brian for writing the article. Thank The Atlantic for having the article. It's just part of this discourse, and I think it's important. The fact that so many hackles were raised, I think, is a good thing, because the reason they're so upset is because he probably touched on some truths. And I think it's important to just have this conversation continue. And I appreciate Brian for even just bringing it up. I think his article is very courageous. You know, these are all excuses, as I keep calling them, excusitarians. And as you can see, there are just so many excuses, and we've heard them all, for eating animals. In fact, I've said before that there are as many excuses for eating animals as there are victims of this cultural habit, and that would be 10 billion in the U.S. alone. But truly, I've heard that many excuses, but I have never heard a good reason. And I think that's really what it comes down to, that these are all ways to just justify what we're doing so we can feel better about something that we really don't need to be doing at all. So I hope that's helpful. I hope you enjoyed it. I will stop now because you've heard my voice for too long. I will be back very soon with the next episode. And drop me a line, become a member, subscribe to the podcast, speak up and speak out for the animals and for your truth. And let's just help create the compassionate world that we all envision. Thank you very much for listening. For the animals, this is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau with Compassionate Cooks.